my lovelies. Welcome. Welcome to Out on the Edge, the radio show where each week, co-hosts Judy McCord, Robin Hamilton, and Betty Priu, queer elders with a combined century of lasting, loving relationships. We present an all-ages tour of what it's like to be gay and gray in North Carolina in these interesting times. Our guest today is Deborah Thomas, who is inspired by her belief that everyone has a spark of sacred creativity and a story to share. She'll provide us with some guidance in sharing our unique stories. Before we get started, we'd like to give a shout out to WCOMLP, Chapel Hill, Carrboro, at 103.5 FM for hosting our show. Out on the Edge is brought to you by the LGBTQ plus Senior Resource Team of the Orange County, North Carolina Department on Aging. We are deeply grateful for their guidance and support. We acknowledge and honor that the town of Carrboro and surrounding land was originally part of the Saponi People's Territory, which also included the Eno, Tutelo, and Shikori Nation. Please join us each week as we interview special guests to share information, resources, insights, and stories for, by, and about our elders in the LGBTQ plus community. You can hear the show on the air Monday afternoons, 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time, or stream us live on wcomfm.org. Our archived shows can be found on the Orange County Department on Aging website at www.orangecountync.gov/OOTE. The Department on Aging website also provides a host of helpful resources and services for seniors in Orange County, North Carolina. Robin, on with the show.
Oh, my God. I'm up. Hi, I'm Robin, and I'm very... Thank you, Judy, for that, and thank you, Deborah, for being here.
Of course.
Deborah and I first met in the summer of 2002 when I was working on A Lesson Before Dying at Deep Dish Theater and continued to work together until it closed in 2015. Since then, our paths have not intersected as much, so it's really wonderful for me to reconnect this past year when we discovered we're both now members of the LGBTQ plus community. What are the odds, right? Sounds like maybe a good starting place for a discussion of personal histories and memoir. So That's our topic for today. The prompt for this, and again, I'm so glad we're having Deborah here to talk about this, because unexpectedly, and we are experiencing a time in history when history is being liquefied, dismantled, eradicated. Its existence made perilous by people who wish to control the narrative and so edit, rewrite existing history. Websites are being scrubbed of minority representation, books are banned and curricula abridged, memorials are being painted over, museums are having their programming dictated. The list gets more horrifying with each passing day. So it seemed to me that a good way to respond to this onslaught is to invest more time and attention in recording history on our own. Creating so many personal records of observed truth, the chronicle of our presence would gain a measure of invulnerability through sheer volume. So that's why we're here, and that is a very light, offhanded question that Deborah's going to tackle. But first, Deborah, tell us about Deborah Thomas.
A little light, offhanded question. I love that, Robin. That's awesome. I should also point out that I am wearing my Reed Band Books t-shirt today in honor of what we're talking about. Thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure to be able to come back home to Orange County. I grew up here, and we spent the majority of our early married life here, and we actually moved away in 2015. So we've only recently come back to the area and to family and to home, so it's great to be back here. As I mentioned, we moved away. We spent 7 years out on the coast and in Fayetteville. And then before that, I was involved in a lot of the theaters around here. But at heart, I've always been a writer. I've always been a storyteller. I think that's what drew me into theater, was being able to help people share their stories that these playwrights have written. And then, of course, the entire team that puts on a theater show. But before that, I worked... And I started writing, of course, in school, as we all do, and then was planning on going into magazine publishing on the editorial side. So I come out of a journalism background, which I think prepares you very well for writing memoir, for writing these stories and sharing these stories that are personal.
Yeah. So that, again, the parallels with I was a designer for so many years, and then when I retired, I started writing again, and it's it's the fulfillment I'm getting from that is equal to the fulfillment I would get from getting a show open, except no tech rehearsals.
Right. still some long days, but no tech rehearsals.
Tech rehearsals. Oh my God. So, okay. So why don't you explain to our listeners and to me, because I just make it up as I go along, what exactly is memoir, particularly flash memoir?
Sure.
The different kinds, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. So people have written their own stories since people have been writing. We typically look now at the bigger umbrella is creative nonfiction. And memoir is a subset of that.
Okay.
So it's rather than a straight biography or autobiography where you're just kind of laying out the facts as they happened,
right,
you're using the creative literature tenets to help tell the story. So that's kind of what memoir is. Typically, it tends to be a little bit shorter, and then you get into flash memoir, which would super short.
That's my understanding.
So,
how does that differ from... I'm not even sure I've got the term right, but fictional biography.
I would imagine that those probably are interchangeable.
I'm probably misremembering the term, but I ran across something like that. I'm sorry, keep going.
That's okay. No, that's okay. Yeah. When you get into, because the umbrella of creative nonfiction is still relatively new, there are a lot of different terms, much as in the LGBTQ community, right? There are always new terms that we're using that we're figuring out exactly what we are and how we want to express, which is beautiful, right? That's why we use the rainbow, because this is just a huge spectrum. And the same for the writing community, right? Like, we're always trying to finesse. We're always trying to find the right word to express what it is that we're doing.
And there's some sort of structure, definitive thing. I mean, I know as someone who creates writing, and it's all very deeply personal for me. I mean, and that's just me. It all comes from my lived experience and everything like that. So... in a way, it's almost all memoir. It's all sort of autobiographical. But when I was looking, there seemed to be a specific, this makes it flash and this makes it not flash. And it's a specific, like, word count or something like that. I mean, it sounds like you're just saying everything keeps evolving and there's no, the parameters are still pretty fluid. Is that right?
I would say yes.
Okay.
I think when you're talking about the idea of a flash piece, a lot of those parameters are going to be set by whomever it is you're giving the piece to.
Yeah.
So.
I am caught in a bind here. Judy's asking me to move a little. I think it might be your headphone volume, because when I'm sitting behind the board, and our listeners don't have to worry about this, but I chew the mic. So I'm not chewing the mic now. I'm just trying to get a good place for it.
So basically the idea is that flash is going to be shorter, right?
Right.
So if you compare it to, say, poetry, that you're looking at something that maybe is a page or maybe 3 or 4 pages rather than a novella, which is typically around 10,000 words, right, or longer, that you're really getting into something that you can read in a short amount of time.
Well, and for our listeners' delight, we both have brought in something of our own that we will have to read to you, and we can then talk about it in just a second. But I just thought of what I think I was trying to say earlier.
Yeah.
What is the difference between flash memoir and prose poetry?
Ah, that is a really good question.
What do you think is the difference?
Yeah. I memoir is always.
I think your memoir is really, really kind of from a personal source. There is some memory and
it can be. Yeah,
prose poetry
isn't necessarily.
Yeah, I see. Okay, that.
But also, I think there's still going to be a lyricism to prose poetry.
A lyricism. Okay.
To poetry that memoir is not necessarily going to have as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. That's because as pretentious as it sounds to me, I started writing some prose poetry to see what it was like. Actually, I had one of them accepted recently.
It's congratulations.
Published later this year.
That's incredible. Congratulations.
I just give the title because the title tells everything you need to know about it. It's called Protocol Droid Writes a Rope Poem. That tells you everything you need to know about that. And I really like it. And then I started looking at things that I was writing, and it became much more personal, like the one I'm going to read it any minute now. And so that's where I started thinking flash memoir. And that really, when I saw your advertising, if that's what you would call it, or looking for participants in your last memoir session, I think ding, 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 ding. And coinciding as it does with the onslaught, that's a delicious word, the onslaught on history that we're all suffering through, and the rise of resistance historians that are out there trying to save it all and everything. It's like, okay, you know, we if we look at graffiti as our cave paintings of the day and recording our history in public art, in public discourse, and just diffusing the legacy histories that have proven to be so vulnerable to manipulation for nefarious means by people who have nothing better to do with their lives.
Right.
That's what kind of prompted me to think about, you know, getting the word out and starting with the memoir, that kind of thing. And I know Judy and we talked briefly at our intro meeting last week. I know Judy wants to talk to you more about sessions at the Seymour Center and making this an ongoing thing. And I'm just so proud that I maybe had something to do with starting that. So,
When I worked with PFLAG in Fayetteville, I was the chapter president there. And one of my favorite things of working with PFLAG is that it is open to all age ranges. And that it is part of that work that they're doing is connecting older generations and younger generations so that they can learn from each other. And about not only about quote unquote how to be LGBTQ, however, wherever you fall in that spectrum, but really how to live your best, most truest self.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I think that's what's so important for our elders, whether they've been living their true life their entire lives or they're just coming into it, is the idea that they're using their own story and their own lived experience to share to help the next generation. We particularly found while I was there that there was a divide between the younger LGBTQ folks knowing their own LGBTQ history, right? Like everybody knows Stonewall because that's a big splashy name and kind of an easy story. But like even in their own literal physical community, like there's been a long history of LGBTQ folks in Fayetteville and nobody had been able to share those stories, right? And so it's that kind of idea of we are not the first ones to do this and being able to share that out.
Absolutely. No, and that and that is something that the hosts, the We Three Weird Sisters here for the Out on the Edge, we've been talking a lot about developing programming that works on that intergenerational aspect of it.
Right.
And that's our thing. We have some calls out to younger members of the community. And I think the point you make very important about elders who have been living their true lives out versus living their true lives closeted.
Right.
versus people who are just coming into their own and realize, wait, this, oh my God, that's what was wrong. And wrong is a wrong word. That's what was incomplete in my life. I mean, and again, I'm speaking about my own personal situation coming into this. I'm not an ally. Ally was a masking thing, but that's another show. But anyway,
I have a friend of mine who we graduated from Orange High a year apart and went to college together. And it wasn't until after they were married, they transitioned and have gone on to create this beautiful career for themselves using their story of transitioning as the, it's not memoir, but it's very much the basis of the fiction that they're telling through their writing. Yeah. And it's really incredible to see how their world has just bloomed, you know, because of that.
That's another story, but I've been putting out my own narrative. My development, my transition, thing like that from years ago when it was still just a thing over here that wasn't me. It was this very disassociative thing. And then I, you know, it's like, oh, wait, no, that's not right. This is me. And I keep working on it. It would now be probably a 10-hour performance if it was all said and done. And that's before we put in the circus acts.
Right. Because that's very important.
Things like that, you know, the tight wire. Anyway, so why don't we quickly, before we keep going, just talk what this is and the power of writing and everything. Let's give our listeners some examples.
Sure.
And I'll go first because I'm the amateur here and you're the professional, and we don't want to leave them with a bad taste. Not that they would. That's one of the things I have to learn is to not be quite so self-depreciating. And I'll get around to that one of these days. Anyway, this is a piece I wrote a few months ago. It came to me. Essentially, again, because we're at an age, us older people, where friends of ours are passing on. You know, and I'm living longer than my college friends and that kind of thing. So that puts me in a very speculative mood sometimes. So this is about some of my closest friends in graduate school. All right. Warm up. Nah. Okay. Saltine nachos on the sunny side of Jumbo. Spring of 1975, a.k.a. my second semester of graduate school, was when, newly and amicably free of what had turned out to be an ill-advised early marriage, my companion d'arm, Starzinski, and I rented an apartment on Eddy Avenue, a couple of blocks from the Missoula campus. This made the constant all-nighters we relied on to get shows sold, opened, run, and struck so much easier to bear by reducing to mere minutes the interruptions of going home for food, rest, bathing, and clean clothing, albeit not necessarily in that order, nor all in the same trip. On a few rare occasions, we found ourselves with a free afternoon between productions, and those lazily developed into domesticated scenarios of Starzinski sitting in the front yard in an old lawn chair girl-watching, with his green bottle of English gin and his green pickled jalapeno slices on white saltines, while Danzer and Lehman and I smoked filtered cigarettes and drank bottomless pots of black coffee laced with the intense idealism of university students who know they are so very, very close to solving the riddle of humanity. Enthused with the passion and commitment of our age, in our age, about the ability of theater to heal, to teach, to celebrate, to unify, to allow society the freedom to reexamine itself and its legacy from multiple perspectives over and over until we as a civilization, as a species, as stardust, finally might stumble upon our redemption. Now, 50 years after those coffee-clatched soirees, it is obvious how tapped into the divine feminine the three of us were. Even me, regardless of my being so deep in my bore performance, I was blind to the blessing. With the recent abrupt realization that I am now somehow, almost certainly, the only one left who participated in these idyllic afternoons, My eulogistic plan is to carefully stopper those Lux memories into many small artisan bottles, like the ones we obsessively sought out every time we would make a run to the global import store to restock our patchouli and incense back when we lived in houses prior to pets and our children and our both, into which I shall place a coffee bean, a bit of tobacco, a labrys, and a jalapeno slice, with the intention that before I die, I will take the lot to the seashore and toss them all into the waves, not so many as to damage the environment, just the exact right number to keep the memory alive. With the beach between my toes, I will give them a standing ovation as I watch the beauty and the peace of those days flow out into the wide world like a sold-out international bus and truck to heal us all. Meanwhile, on an eddy avenue in a parallel space-time continuum just slightly out of phase with our own, Minerva, decompressing after a long morning auditioning mice and stage moms for the upcoming Community Thespian Troupe's YA production of The Pied Piper of Hamelin at the Wilma, delivers the raucous punchline to a dirty joke as she gets up to empty the ashtrays and put on a fresh pot of Robusta, while Von Bingen prepares for her sitar lesson with Saraswati. The three pause for a shared moment of head-shaking when they hear Coyote out front trying futilely to be respectful in his effusive appreciation of passing co-eds as the sunlight coming in the window over the sink shimmers and dances across the old oak kitchen floor in joyous exultation. The end. It's a good thing you can't blush on a microphone.
Congratulations.
But that was it. And when you and folks are home who can't see, Deborah has been making copious notes, and I'm going to get probably lots of corrections after the show. But now we have Deborah bring one of her own, and I would just let her do the setup and everything. I don't need to.
I have not read this out loud, so I will just preface it with that. This was the first piece I wrote that has wound up turning into a chapbook, and which I've submitted to a local press. I haven't heard back yet. This piece is called Sing and Be Happy. Where the Soul Never Dies came on the Sirius XM station my husband was listening to in the truck the other day while we were on our way to dinner. I immediately sang every verse, every chorus in perfect alto harmony. I teared up a lot. My husband stared at me, dumbfounded at the sudden song knowledge, then laughed. I laughed, too, as I wiped away the tears. It's been almost 30 years since I was regularly singing hymns. Our new church has participatory singing, but the songs are not the hymns of my youth. And I may belt out in the car with 80s classics and 90s bangers, but those don't generally make me cry. Dear friends, there'll be no sad farewells. There'll be no tear-dimmed eyes, where all is peace and joy and love, and the soul of man never dies. One of the few things I do miss from the church of my youth is singing. The church I grew up in was an all a cappella, everybody sings style of church. No listening to a choir of perfect voices. No expecting everyone to understand pitch. No training on sight reading. Just open the hymnal to the requested number and do your best. We were told, God doesn't care what you sound like, just that your heart is in praise to Him. For some reason, my mother, who I've since learned is a contralto and prefers to sing in her higher register, sang the alto part when I was young. Since I am a great mimic, even if I cannot sight read and I don't have natural perfect pitch, I learned to sing alto and harmony in church. She taught me how to follow along the musical notes and which lines were ours. I have since come to learn a little bit about the history of shape note singing, how it was a way for functionally illiterate people to still be able to follow along with singing hymns, as the words themselves were often not printed or were done as a call and response with the song leader. All I knew growing up was the little triangles, ovals, and squares were funny to look at. Eventually, I started to realize there were musical differences to whether the shape was colored in or not, or if there was a dot or crescent line beside it. For the most part, I just sang what my mom sang, until I got too old to sit with my parents. Ew, she says in Teenager. Mm-hmm. And then I sat with my friends. And we'd all grown up singing the songs, so we all knew our parts. I loved Fifth Sundays, because those, for some unknown reason, were song Sundays for the evening service. Yes, I was at one of those churches with both Sunday morning and evening services, which, with the exception of everyone taking communion, were pretty similar in content. But the fifth Sunday of the month, those were special. Since they only happened about once a quarter, I suppose leadership felt they weren't doing any real lasting spiritual harm to let us just sing the entire service. Even youth group, every weekly meeting or weekend or revival I attended, we sang the same way. If the youth group director wasn't also a trained song leader, we just bumbled our way through the songs as best we could. Youth group meetings were laid out pretty much like the main, that is, adult services. Sing a few songs, have a lesson, another song, prayer circles. Those songs were not in the hymnal. Some enterprising soul had at some point typed them up and printed out and stapled together a songbook of sorts, so we at least had the words. This was before the internet. There were no YouTube videos, no Instagram reels, no TikToks. You just had to memorize the melody. And that's why these songs live deep within me. They are purely muscle memory. And as science experiments have shown that auditory processing is in the same region of the brain as emotional memories, these songs trigger emotional responses that might not so easily set off otherwise. That is, I sing hymns and I cry. I cry for trying to fit in for so long before walking away. I cry for feeling left out. I cry for missing family and friends who stayed. I cry for knowing I won't have the experience again. Not like that. Not like it was. I cry because I want this one thing so badly, to hear my voice meld with others in a non-judgmental, pure community kind of way. But I refuse to put up with the control and phobias that go along with being in that environment. If we were really lucky, the song leader on those fifth Sundays would do two things. He, always a he, would actually ask us to sit in sections. Sopranos up front, altos behind, tenors here, bass here. And he would take requests. That meant we sounded magnificent, and the altos could finally ask for the few hymns we took lead on. Home of the Soul, Jesus Hold My Hand, and my favorite, Sing and Be Happy. Those evenings were probably the closest I came to a divine experience. Sing and you'll be happy today. Press along to the goal. Trust in him who leadeth the way. He is keeping your soul. Let the world know where you belong. Look to Jesus and pray. Lift your voice and praise him in song. Sing and be happy today.
Thank you. That was beautiful. And we will talk about that right now, though, to help break up the flow. We're going to go back to Judy, who has something very important to share with our audience.
This is a word from our sponsor, the Orange County Department on Aging. Make a note on your calendar now for our picnic with pride at the Blackwood Farm Park on October 4th from noon to 3. Join us as we celebrate National Coming Out Day with a joyful afternoon of community, connection, and courage. Whether you're out, coming out, or supporting someone on their journey, this is a space for everyone to feel seen, safe, and celebrated. Your story matters. Your presence is powerful. That's October 4th at Blackwood Farm Park. More details to come. Now back to you, Robin.
All right. And that actually kind of segues into what I was hoping we would get to for part of the show is the LGBTQ experience as a source of memoir.
Mm-hmm.
Limited to or specifically the people's coming out experiences, but I mean, there's so much personal processing. Sorry, peas in front of the mic. I have so much to learn. But quickly, before we get into some of the specifics of that, how do your classes work? How do they set up? What kind of process do you go through? And do they lead to unexpected results of a non-written variety, like people writing songs from memoir or play scripts or visual representations of pictures, sketches, and things like that? So how does a Deborah Thomas memoir session work?
So my writing groups run for 12 weeks. And everyone is basically, we set out at the beginning of that to say, okay, what do you want to have accomplished by the end of these 12 weeks? So it could be a collection of poems. It could be a collection of songs. We have had people who are working on straight novels, straight fictional novels. We've had people working on memoir. We've had people who are basically done with their pieces and just need some fine tuning and some feedback, and then they want to have the accountability of actually submitting and trying to find a place for them to live. So I want to make it as I want to make my sessions as copacetic, as comfortable for the participants as possible, so that you actually write, so that it's not something you're dreading doing, right?
Right.
And they're very small. I don't think I've done one that's been over six people, including myself. And so that's purposeful, so that it's a small container.
My instinct is that's a perfect size for that kind of thing. How long do the sessions last?
An hour.
An hour?
Yeah. And then, so the idea is that you're gonna work on whatever it is that you're writing during the week, and then we come back and share out ahead of time, so that, and a lot of what I like to do is for people to bring their pieces in and go, okay, I've got a problem that I can't solve with my piece. Mm-hmm. And so I want to use this brain trust essentially, right? And see how I can figure out how to solve it.
So the sessions are actually constructive sessions rather than just, okay, you're going to write for 15 minutes and come back.
Right. And
so
we
just generally, just being really rough.
Yeah. And we do that sometimes, but usually those nights are everybody's coming in and going, I didn't get my writing done this week. And I go, okay, great. Then let's, we're going to sit here together, turn our cameras off. We're going to write for 30 minutes and then we'll come back and report out.
Right. Yeah. Are they live or virtual or hybrid?
Live.
They are live?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
So then,
online, we're all at home or wherever, but they are live.
Yeah. That's what I meant. I meant virtual versus physically
correct.
In a room like we are now.
Yes,
but it is online. No, that's very similar to a playwriting cohort I was part of several years ago. But so have you in your sessions had a number of LGBTQ queer people coming out and working on memoirs, or is that new, or is it, how does that fit into your mix so far?
Yeah. I mean, I'm one of those people that I know a lot of queer people, and I also assume that everybody is queer until otherwise.
Well, we are all in our own ways.
I'm pretty sure that the majority of the people I've worked with would probably identify as queer in some form or fashion.
Well, which is one of the most inexplicable things about my not coming out for so long, being in an industry that everybody's queer, and I was queer for theater, but I didn't think that, I thought that was the end of it. So,
I've worked with a lot of different folks. I would say that I am particularly interested at this point in memoir, just because that is what I am myself working on writing right now.
Yeah.
And
well,
so
no,
it would be nice to be, working with other
people. It also gives you a chance to bring in some of your editor experience.
Correct,
those chops, anything like that. So and I don't want to put you on the spot any more than I already have, but what kind of recommendations or suggestions would you have if we come in with Judy and Betty when you would meet her and start to format us? And I have no idea what I'm talking about, but I'm just going to say this.
Sure.
Put words out in front of me. But let's say we're setting up sessions for you to run at the Seymour.
At the Seymour.
And we would, as members of the LGBTQ resource team frame it as a queer event for people to come, how do you think that would inform what you do? Would it change it at all? And let's talk some about the importance of trying to get that kind of thing going. Just, again, as they started off with, I mean, you're talking about people in Fayetteville who don't know the queer history of Fayetteville. And I cannot tell you the number of trans people I have met in the 2 years that I've been talking to trans people
that
don't know about Compton's cafeteria. In San Francisco, predating Stonewall by 3 years or thereabouts or something like that. And it's like, yeah, a bunch of trans women rioted right there in the Tenderloin. You know, I used to go by there all the time when I was in San Francisco and didn't know it. So, yeah, there's a lot of history that needs to be out there and can be incorporated into these. So, I'm trying really hard not to answer my own question, which is really a bad thing that I do, and I apologize. But how would you do? What would you do with that?
Well, I want to start by reminding folks that writing and editing are two completely different skills and tasks for a written piece. And so, for people who, if they were new writers or relatively hadn't done it in a while, had done it before but haven't done it in a while, and wanted to share these stories, I would probably go in saying, okay, we are going to get to the end of this time period, and I want you to have three or four, perhaps, say it's an 8-week session that we're setting up, right? I would probably say, okay, I want you to come out of this with maybe somewhere between 3 and 5 of your stories, your personal lived experience stories, that you have written and we have lightly edited so that then you feel comfortable sharing them with someone outside of this room, right? And then they can decide what of their lived experience that wants to be. Way back, if it's something new, if it's, you know, how they've approached life,
Making me imagine an open mic night for graduation, public invited.
I mean, that would be super awesome. Yeah, we've done, there were a couple of cohorts that everybody was local, even though we still did most of the sessions. We still did all of the sessions virtually because we were all local for the 12th week. We actually got together in person and shared, and that was a lot of fun. Yeah.
I mean, that's ultimately, I think the whole idea of being able to do that has expanded our opportunities so much and has made the world so much smaller, too. I mean, I've had, for several years, I had season tickets to the Globe in London, and I would just come in and watch. The live shows would be live and everything, but the next year they would be in their archives, and I could watch all of this, I could watch, it was unlimited, you know, the whole season, like everything they had in the library. And I'm like, I'm watching Shakespeare in London. and just, there's so much of that. And so it's been very disappointing to me, again, as my theater nerd, that a lot of theaters that were doing that regularly during COVID, their funding dried up. And so they're not doing that so much. And it all moves, it all evolves, it keeps. We'll find a balance, but I'm very excited as a writer, and particularly at this point in my life, and yapping endlessly about my life and that kind of thing, that to have a virtual outlet for that. Do you, as an editor, do you? Does the sheer volume of stuff that is being created now that we have this untapped internet of being able to put stuff out there, we don't necessarily need to get into self-publishing now, but that's one of my topics for one of these shows.
Yeah.
To take the memoirs that you were talking about generating and we will be creating and that kind of thing, and then getting out to a broader audience, you know, or setting up YouTube channels or TikTok or something where you just sit there and read, like, you know, open mic nights, but virtual ones. So have you, again, as an editor, been experiencing too much material to process, or is that about the same? Or since you're not limited to getting written paper hard copy submissions quite so much anymore, if at all?
Our creative nonfiction, so my day job is I work with the, I'm the digital editor of the North Carolina Literary Review, and we run a creative nonfiction open submission window every year that runs in January and February. And I would say that our submissions have probably, I mean, they may have gone up a little, but not a ton. But we're also looking for longer pieces, which I think I would imagine that places that are looking that are welcome to shorter pieces that are particularly looking for flash or, you know, 5,000 words
there are
or whatever.
A lot of those very specific, say,
right? Yeah.
This. Yeah.
They're just they're probably inundated. And then the idea. And then of course we also only take unpublished work. So for people who have, and we consider if you've got a personal blog, if you've got a website, if you've got, you know, your local paper, you know, another online magazine, those have all been published.
Right.
We don't take those.
Realize that neither of us can now publish our pieces today because we read them online.
I think it's great that there is that opportunity, though, that particular gatekeeper is not going to keep these kinds of stories from being shared.
Good.
Right?
Okay, yeah.
Whereas 40, 50, 60 years ago, that would have been the case.
Speak 50 years ago when I was typing my master's thesis, and I'd have to do an entire page because of one missed keystroke that I would find. And I'd be like, oh, my God. And then because of that, it wouldn't line up, and I would have to then type the next page. Because I was just like, oh. But actually, that brings up a point of incorporating in this carpet bombing of the necessity of memoir that we're talking about and trying to develop a conversation on. You had mentioned intergenerational stuff before. Do your sessions, are they very specifically intergenerational, and are you noticing anything different about, I mean, younger people have less memories than older people? Have you noticed anything like that, or is it?
Most of the sessions that I've run so far have been, I would say they've all been within 10 years of my own age range. So I've been working with Gen Xers. I've been working with millennials, right?
Okay.
Not to say that I wouldn't otherwise.
No, I'm thinking more about what the idea of getting people excited about creating memoir.
Right.
Because it's pretty cut and dried, and say their history is they're erasing our history. We have to write this down. It's not really a sexy sell.
Sure. Yeah. You know? Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at like our established fiction writers, you know, I work with North Carolina writers, so you know, if you were looking at like Lee Smith's body of work or Clyde Edgerton's body of work, or a little bit. I mean, Lee Smith lives in Hillsborough, but, you know, Daniel Wallace is, you know, here. You know, he just issued a memoir that was really great.
Daniel did?
Mm-hmm, oh. Yeah. In the spring. And that may be right. Don't hold me on that time period. He just issued a memoir.
No, that's the, yeah.
You know, and that's true for a lot of our writers, that they may start out as fictional writers or they may start out doing something different, but then eventually they get to the point where they're like, oh no, there is this personal story that I want to share.
Yeah.
And so I think wherever you find yourself in life, they're likely, I mean, we do it at parties, right? Like we do it at get-togethers when we hang out, we share stories. You know, how many of the late night rehearsals were sharing stories about other shows that we did? And so this is just kind of moving it into we want to be able to have them not only for ourselves, but for future generations to be able to read.
Yeah, and I think there's You are, you're working on a book, as I understand it, of North Carolina theater and doing adaptations of North Carolina authors. Is that too specific, or is that Or is it?
So the book length project is called The Stage is Open, Triangle Theater Community from 1990 to 2015. So 25 years of that.
Right.
There is a chapter within the book of North Carolina, of those theaters adapting specifically North Carolina authors for the stage.
Okay.
There used to be a very vibrant program at UNC in the Communication Studies Department that did a lot of work with Lee Smith, Joe McCorkle, Clyde's work. I think there were a couple of others that I'm forgetting off. No, there were like a dozen. So there were quite a few that they adapted. So that's going to be a chapter within the book.
Okay, all right. So that's a chapter. Mm-hmm. But the book itself,
mm-hmm.
I'm glad you said that because my what prompted it in my head was that the book itself is a history of Triangle Theater, right? More or less.
That very specific 25-year time period, yeah.
Say it again.
That very specific 25-year time period.
Of course, yeah. And, and I didn't mean to make any.
That's okay.
Thing that, but if I'm remembering right, that is basically your one of your primary means of gathering that information is from personal memory of people who lived it and did it. So
correct.
It's basically a community memoir.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, you could absolutely look at it that way.
I think. In the framing of this particular show, just work memoir into the title, and you'll only have to give me 3% of the royalties.
Yeah, absolutely.
We got about 10 minutes, not quite, but about 10 minutes. And I just wondered if, again, I talk so much. I apologize.
That's
for
okay.
That. It's from all the years of teaching when students would not respond to me. I just had to keep talking to keep myself awake. What haven't I asked you that you really wanted to make sure people know about memoir and the value of it and the necessity of it in 2025 in the United States?
I was thinking about this question or something along those lines this morning as I was doing my own morning writing, own morning pages this morning. When I think back about, I would give anything to have my grandmother's journals, diaries, writing, like in general. And so I think of it as I am writing my story or I'm helping other folks to share their stories because eventually there is going to be someone 2, 3, 4, 5 generations. We still read Samuel Johnson's diaries, right? I mean, that we're talking several hundreds of years at this point.
Yeah.
That there's going to be someone who is going to go, I don't know why I am the way I am. I wish I knew some of my lineage's stories so that it could better help me understand myself.
Right. I'm the only person in the entire history of the universe who's ever experienced this particular
correct.
Problem.
Right.
Oh, wait, what's this over here?
Yeah. Yeah. So for me, it's less about I'm writing for my own particular audience of one as I'm writing for an audience of one that's somewhere in the future.
That's a good point of writing for yourself and not writing.
Which is great. The idea of morning pages is really great for that. You're writing for yourself. You're writing to get it out of your head, to see what is interesting, to see what you want to spend a significant chunk of time working on. And then you move into the editing process, right? So there have been a lot of things that I've put down and I'm like, I think I want to write about this. And then I get it in the morning pages and I'm like, that was it. I'm done. I don't need to explore that anymore. I'm good.
I have so many titles of poems that the title says it all, so I don't have to write the actual poem.
Yeah. But one of the questions that, or one of the things that you said earlier that you were going to touch on was the idea, were there other art forms that lend itself to memoir, right? And I have, a very good theater friend of mine, actually, her solo performance pieces are basically all memoir. So she had joined one of my writing cohorts to kind of get into the planning phase for her, this mm-hmm. third piece of this trilogy that she's kind of framing. She's already done the first two, and they were like strictly 100% memoir that she then scripted, choreographed, propped, costumed, all of the things.
And that puts me in mind mm-hmm. of Sam Peterson, who's in The Triangle, who we're going to be getting on a show at some point. We have to pin him down. We worked together doing a show that he wrote about his own journey as a trans man. And his memoir was as a script that way. He's also written a couple of books. But, I had not even made that connection between, so many solo performances are based entirely on memoir.
Right.
It's a good point. And I think, I really am excited about the idea of coming up with something to expand this for the queer elder community mm-hmm. through Seymour. And we'll figure it out. People who know more about that, i.e. Judy and Betty, than I, how that all works, we'll see about getting that into the works.
I mean, I think particularly in this community, you know, Chapel Hill and Carver and Orange County have, I don't know about always, but there has been this idea that they are very much more welcoming to the rainbow community than other portions of the state. So there's probably a richer history here than even we know about, right?
No, that's actually one of the things Betty has talked about, and she's going to be working on putting some shows together specifically about queer history in the Triangle, the focus on women's music in the Triangle, and just all that. So which is one of the reasons that we got really excited about doing the show.
Yeah, right.
Is to cover those voids, even, that sort of a thing. And
I mean, the Durham queer history has, over the past several years, been touched on a lot, right? Like, and so to move it this direction, I think the time is right for that.
Yeah, I mean, because you're certainly this is not going to be the only time we have you here.
I hope not. I would love to come back and talk to y'all. Yeah,
no, this is great, Ben. And promise, I would set you and Betty up because she's much better at this than I am because she doesn't keep talking about, I just had this idea, blah, blah, blah.
No, I love it. It's great.
So,
it's great.
But I really do think we could. Judy, did you have any questions about anything we didn't cover that you were tantalized by?
Oh, my gosh.
Everything.
All of that. I was in tears.
All right.
Yeah, listening to your flash memoir.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Beautiful stories. Thank you so much.
Yeah, this has been really enlightening, and I'm probably going to wind up writing about it when I get
home. I mean, I will too.
I will, sure.
Thank you very much, and let's go ahead and let Judy walk us out.
Sure.
All right. Thank you so much, Deborah, for joining us today, and I'm really looking forward to the rest of the story here. Thanks again to WCOMLP Chapel Hill Carborough at 103.5 FM. And the Orange County, North Carolina Department on Aging for making Out on the Edge possible. Thank you, listeners, for your support and for sharing our stories beyond Orange County. Do you have questions or ideas for future shows? Please contact us, outontheedgeradio@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. Join us next week as we interview Heather Burkhart, Associate Director for Outreach and Advocacy with ARP in the Triangle Region. Till then, here's a quote from Kim McManus. Your heartache is someone else's hope. If you make it through, somebody else is going to make it through. Tell your story. Take care of one another, my friends.
Transitioned based on the isolation of the COVID lockdown.
Oh my gosh, I cannot believe.
That's our show, not yours.
All right, but oh gosh, and we have 2 minutes left. But Yeah, and it's funny, when I became a caregiver at 47 and then again at 49, I was like, great, now I've become a statistic. Because, you know, woman, daughter, caring for their parents and blowing up everything at 47 and 49. So, yeah, we all have our different times. Okay, weird thing. Betty.
I'm just going to go real quick.
Yeah.
Grew up in southern Louisiana, so I'm a real Cajun. One of those.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
southern.
So 20 years there, 10 years in Austin, Texas, when it was just getting cool. Yeah, it was a wonderful place to be. And then ended up here because my wife had moved here after we knew each other as undergraduates in college in Louisiana, and we're the two token straight girls in the dormitory. That's another story for another day. We ended up getting together. She moved to North Carolina, back to Louisiana. We dated, came back here, and I moved here. And my job was in the tech industry. I was a technical writer. And this was one of the top, like, six places in the U.S. to do that kind of work in the early 90s. So, you know, came to this area and just and really got immersed in the culture after a while. And there was a very vibrant lesbian scene here. Gays and lesbians don't always mix. You have to make an effort.
Okay.
And so there was a very vibrant lesbian feminist scene that we kind of hooked into in various ways. So, yeah, so it's been, and so we've been together 33 years and officially married for 20. So
Mazel tov. So all three of you have been, Robin, how long have you been with your wife?
We've been together 40 years. We've been married 37.
Okay, so there's so much. I mean, how amazing. Okay, what I would love to do in our 10 seconds left, but what I'd love to do on your show, and or something that...
You want to come interview us?
I would, actually. But also, as since I fall under the ally community, you each shared things that I wonder, what am I allowed to ask about? So I'm going to leave you with that, because I am sure our audience has a ton of follow-up questions, you know, navigating couples that, you know, where one couple comes out later as trans and you've been together for so long, and how do you, how does that go from being a same-sex couple to actually now a different gender? Like, how does that work? Or the other way around. So I have so many questions.
Well, and I would say there's no
question. Oh, that's right, because Robin.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
But there's no question that's off limits. We can choose to not answer.
Yeah.
But there's no question that that's off limits.
Okay. Well, that's maybe that's a show. It's another show I'd love to have on Aging Well Together. It's another show or that you all can have. And literally, I'd love to title it, you know, No Questions Off Limits. Or what questions are, you know, I try to be good and I try to be politically correct. And before woke was a bad four-letter word, it was like, oh, okay, I want to say the right thing. And so this whole issue of what's okay to ask about and what you, okay. I cannot thank you enough. Judy McCord, Robin Hamilton, and Betty Priu, thank you so much for coming on the Aging Well Together show. So excited for Out on the Edge. It's going to come in August. Thank you, WCOM, for creating such a safe and welcoming home for both shows. Thank you, Orange County Department on Aging, for sponsoring both shows. And listeners, wherever you are, whether you're listening, driving around, or listening through the computer, or listening to one of our pre-recorded show, while we all like to hear our voices, and we'll make sure Robin enjoys hearing her voice soon enough, really, it's the fact that you listen to us that makes it so special. So thank you so much to all. We'll be right back.